Cube 93. Bring it live to them like this.
It's time for Cube to bring it to the table. Issues that affect your community. Street Beat.
Street Beat.
With Tony B.
That's right.
On Cube 93.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Street Beat. Street Beat is Cube 93's public affairs show that keeps you in touch with the beat of the city. Well, what we want to do this morning is cool your Sunday morning out. School,
TB,
we're going to cool their Sunday morning out.
Cool it out, T. How are we going to do that, TB?
How are we going to cool it out?
Yes.
You know, back in the day, man, it was cool to play jazz.
Okay, all yeah, right.
I'm it's still you. Cool.
It's yeah, still cool thing.
To play jazz.
Yes, sir.
In Seattle, we have a legendary jazz guitarist who is... played this circuit, played around the world, around the country, Mr. Michael Powers.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, he'll be joining us this Sunday morning to help us cool the morning
cool.
out.
Cool, I gotta get that. Cool, yeah. Am I saying it right? Cool. Okay.
Yeah. Now, I know you are a hip-hop aficionado.
Yeah, of course, that's my thing.
Yeah, how do you relate cool, for you personally, to hip-hop?
Cool and hip-hop is just, it's more of a, I don't know if it's necessarily a sound like jazz. You know, jazz just comes off with a cool sound to me. You know, even the name jazz. Cool for hip-hop is more of the way you are, how you walk, talk.
More of an attitude and style.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
You know what, Scoot? Jazz was the first hip-hop.
Okay.
Yeah, jazz was the first hip-hop.
Well, I'm sure you're going to educate me today.
Yeah, everything that hip-hop's doing now, jazz did before.
Let me find out.
All right. Our guest joining us this morning, again, Seattle guitarist, celebrating his new CD, 20 songs for 20 years.
Yes, sir.
And Scoot, I know you have something on deck for Michael Powers.
Yeah, we're going to throw a little background music for Michael Powers, and we got some special songs for Michael Powers, too.
Okay. Now, just cool out.
Cool.
That's how we're going to do it.
Set the pace.
We're going to set the pace.
All right, that's what's up.
Cool them out. Our guest again is Mr. Michael Powers. He's going to be here to talk to us about jazz, jazz in schools, and how hip-hop and jazz have melded together. We'll be back to talk with Mr. Michael Powers this Memorial Day weekend about, well, his new CD, jazz, music in general, music theory. If you love music, Scoop.
Yes, sir.
You don't want to miss this show.
Not today.
Yeah, and I'm going to go put you in the Wayback Machine.
Okay, take me back, TB.
All right, for all of those who remember the sold-out SOS band Michael Powers concert, which some folks still today say was the best concert ever, you don't want to miss this show.
No, sir.
It's about music.
SOS band, TB.
SOS
band. You took that back.
Way back. I said the Wayback Machine.
You did.
All right? We'll be back with our guest Michael Powers after his solo virtuoso guitar rendition, jazz style. Thank you. It's Tony B, and joining me in the studio. Now, see, I want to call him a legend, but that would be like making him seem older than he really is. But if you know anything about the music scene in Seattle, this name is going to be one that rings a bell. In the studio with me, I know you're not from Seattle, but I'm going to call you Seattle. Well, Seattle's own.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I'm a musical product of Seattle. Yeah. I didn't start playing music till I got here.
My guest is Mr. Michael Powers. How are you doing, my man?
I'm doing great. Good to see you.
Good have you in the studio.
Oh, yeah. It's good to be here.
Well, it's been too long, but what a great occasion to have you in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
20 years, 20 songs. The new CD is coming out.
That's correct.
That's
June
correct.
June 1st, it's dropping.
Okay. But I want to talk to you, man. For anybody who hasn't had the opportunity to actually get to know you but has enjoyed you playing, this is where you want to be right now. Here's your opportunity to find out everything you wanted to know about Michael Powers but couldn't ask him because he's always gigging.
Yeah, that's true.
So first of all, where were you born? How did you come to be? Where were you at?
I was actually born in New York.
New York.
And as my mom, who still has a New York accent, says, Long Island.
Uh-huh.
And we left there when I was about five. We went to the San Francisco Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there from that time until, when I finished high school. And then we moved up here to Seattle. Mm-hmm. So I've been here since just after high school. And I've been able to learn how to play music and put my whole career together here. I really learned how to play in Washington.
See, because the assumption would be you picked up a guitar at the age three, you know?
It's a little weird, isn't it?
And have been playing ever since, but you didn't actually start playing until later in your teen years, right?
Yeah, I think it was some kind of a psychic reference to it. If you guys go to my website, you'll see the cover of my new CD, and we found this picture of me when I was three, and mm-hmm. I had a pinwheel in my hand,
mm-hmm.
and I think I was trying to play the guitar, but no one picked up on that. They took a picture, and it's actually going to be used on the cover of the new CD, but I didn't get interested in it until something happened. I broke my wrist. Mm-hmm. I fell off a skateboard,
mm-hmm.
and the wrist break on my left hand, which is like a key hand for a right-handed guitar player. It was in a cast for so long that the whole forearm, the muscle, had all shrunken down.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to the doctor, and while I was in the cast, I saw a movie of Jimi Hendrix.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a documentary about his life. And I said, wow, I'd like to do that. Now, I wasn't sure if it was because I liked the guitar or it looked like this was a good way to meet girls. I'm not sure, but somewhere in there.
A little of both. Huh?
Yeah. And I had like the big afro. I had some platform shoes and the headband and all that. And I was trying to play like Jimi Hendrix. And it turned out to be excellent therapy for building up the muscle and all that. And, you know, there everything happened. So I haven't been on a skateboard since, but it all kind of worked out.
So before then, you had no real particular interest in music? Because then again, if it was the Bay Area, they were pretty famous for a really eclectic music scene down there. And at that time, you really weren't drawn to music or?
Not at all, as far as becoming involved in performing in it. I've always really enjoyed music. I was one of those kids that, you know, I could remember every commercial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever the jingle was, mm-hmm. you know, in it. And for a while, we lived actually at the corner of Waller and Ashbury in San Francisco proper. And that was one block from Hayden Ashbury. Mm-hmm. I was 7 years old. That was during the Summer of Love,
mm-hmm.
1967. And there were some people that lived next door that were always making noise. You know, just loud all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be listening and say, oh, sounds okay. And my mom would call the police on them like every day.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come and they would kind of quiet them down. I found out later that was the Grateful Dead that lived next door. So yeah, I guess I got some music influence by osmosis, you know, being around there. I'd get on my little Schwinn Stingray and run down, and it was just a few blocks down to Golden Gate Park. And, you know, Santana would be doing a concert, Tower Power, Cold Blood, all those people you would think of from that era.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did get to hear a lot of music. Even the famous Fillmore West,
mm-hmm.
They let kids in there. So I would get to go and listen to music. But never was interested until after that point, you know, okay. As far as actually performing.
So you pick up a guitar, you begin to finger it just for the exercise,
yep.
Really. And where did composing come into the picture? I guess we're going to start there. Did you always know that you wanted to write your own music? Was that part of it? Because, say, you didn't think about it before, or was it from playing other folks' music that you began to realize, hey, wait a minute, I've got some thoughts and ideas of my own about how this instrument can work?
Well, definitely. When you're first learning, you want to emulate whoever you're playing like. And I wanted to play like Jimi Hendrix, so I did that. And then after a while, I kind of got into Santana because it had the same energy, but it had a little bit more like technical scales and stuff. He had minor scales and things that he was doing. And then I was a big Santana fan. And then one night I was watching, I think it was called The Midnight Special. Mm-hmm. And Santana was on there. And then some guy named George Benson walked out.
Mm-hmm. George Benson.
I said, okay. Who's this guy? I mean, to me, it was like, who's this guy with this big, weird guitar? Mm-hmm. Guitar was as big as him, you know. He's, you know, and he came out and they played, I think, Breezin' together. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that's kind of cool. What's that about? So I got into him. Then I found out he learned how to play by listening to Wes Montgomery. So after a while, I got into him and went on from there. And after a while, I realized, you know, I started playing in top 40 bands. And that, once again, you're learning from the record. I learned how to play by ear at first. Mm-hmm. I did that for a while, and I found out that they could have you or not, and you're kind of sitting around waiting. You're not the singer. You're not the main focus in that kind of a situation. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, I better start learning about the technical part of music and maybe learn about writing. I had kind of started making up my own little riffs and stuff that were variations on what I'd learned. But it was the drive to start to want to create my own career and my own path and my own identity mm-hmm. that got me into writing and
now,
composing.
How familiar were you at this point with Seattle's history of musicians, the folks who had been through here? Did that impact you at all?
Initially, not. I wasn't that familiar. It was just because my mom decided to move here and I mm-hmm. ended up here. But as it went on, obviously, I knew Jimi Hendrix was from here and he was a big influence. I had the honor of getting to meet his dad and having his dad come hear me play and, you know, things like that. But later on, as I started really getting into jazz, and I decided to go to Cornish mm-hmm. Institute and get a degree and learn about the technical aspects of everything, that's when I learned more about the history and, you know, how rich it was, the fact that Ray Charles was here, Quincy Jones was here, mm-hmm. you know, Bumps Blackwell, all these great bands, and that, you know, in the post-war era, this place was wide open. It was almost like Las Vegas here. It was like... Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, kind of a wild nightlife kind of place that I wasn't experiencing when I got here, you know, because they changed the liquor laws, they changed the venue laws and all that to kind of quiet it down and make it more of a bedroom community. But mm-hmm. back in that time when this was a staging area for the Pacific Theater in the World War II, that's really what made this such an interesting town as far as entertainment goes. Mm-hmm. And I've learned about that since.
For a lot of folks out there who are maybe picking up a guitar, want to pick up their guitar, have their kids pick up a guitar,
yes.
You mentioned first you learned by ear.
Yes.
How was that experience, learning by ear? Do you recommend that? Do you think that's valuable? How important of a role does that play for someone like you who not only plays but also composes?
I feel fortunate that I came at it from that direction because my ears are always open. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people that first only learn how to read music, mm-hmm. it's a little bit like a typist. If you hand a typist something to dictate and to write down, you know, they can be very efficient at getting exactly what they hear and blah, blah, blah. But if you ask them afterwards, what did that document say? They'll go, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, because they're not focused in that way. It's a mm-hmm. different kind of a way of perceiving things. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you, you know, you get somebody to listen to it and write it down, maybe manually, or to say it back to you, which is really what learning by ear musically is. You have to then just kind of regurgitate it and put it back out there and mm-hmm. perform it back. Then you have maybe a little bit more understanding of the content and the meaning and the emotion behind it. Mm-hmm. But obviously, it's valuable to be able to do both, and I could only go so far just mm-hmm. playing by ear. I wouldn't be able to, you know, open myself up. The model that I had for somebody that was just going to be an instrumentalist and didn't sing was to also make sure I was a good studio musician mm-hmm. and to be able to, you know, the people in L.A. like Larry Carlton, Lee Ritenour. These guys were my role models. Like, okay, I want to be like them, be able to come in, whatever they hand me, you know, be able to handle it. Mm-hmm. And it was important to me to get both sides. And, you know, you have the one side of your brain is the creative side. The other side is the technical side. So the mm-hmm. technical kind of side of my brain wanted to know what was going on, mm-hmm. you know, so wanted to know and have a way to structure and explain all of this stuff in a music theory and mm-hmm. with the notes and be able to analyze the harmonic progressions and all that stuff that I got at college. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, for me, it worked best. There are great classical musicians who also play with that thing that sounds like they're kind of playing by ear. I mm-hmm. think Yo-Yo Ma is one of them. Mm-hmm. Itzhak Perlman is mm-hmm. one of them. There's a new young Asian pianist named Lang Lang that plays like that. And I think if that is what turns you on and you can pick up the instrument and start to do something by ear, then that's a great way to get in.
You're listening to Street Beat. It's me, your host, Tony B, cooling you out on a Sunday morning. Special guest Michael Powers will be back.
Street Beat,
you know,
with Tony B.
Cube 93.
Welcome back to Street Beat. It's me, your host, Tony B. It is Memorial Day weekend, and this morning we are giving you the opportunity to hear Mr. Michael Powers' CD, In Spurts, 20 songs for 20 years before it actually hits the street. Our guest joining us again right here on Street Beat is Mr. Michael Powers. Now, you did address it a little bit here, mm-hmm. but since we have you here again, now there's the other side of it. You've mentioned more than a couple times here the technical
yes.
aspect
yes.
Of the music. And so let's talk about that now. First, there's the part where you're playing by ear, and
yes.
And then you move into it, you decide you want to conquer the technical part of it. Mm-hmm. How did that change you as a musician? What did it bring to the table to kind of put you in a position where you are today?
I was hanging out with a friend the other day, and we were just, you know, doing something, and there was some music on in the background, and I was like, hey, you know, that's cool. It's got a cool snare on it, and there's some nice reverb on it. And they said, don't you ever turn it off and quit analyzing stuff? You know, can't you just listen and enjoy the music? Mm-hmm. And I think on some level, it has that tape always going in my brain, you know, mm-hmm. when you get really well versed and you know the inside out of the technical stuff, you're always kind of tearing stuff apart. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's a little side effect. It's hard for me to kind of turn that off and not try to figure out, hey, what kind of chord was that I heard, and mm-hmm. you know, what kind of bass line was that, you know, or whatever. But I think that it's important to learn the technical stuff, to learn the harmony, to learn all your scales, and to that way you can actually increase your vocabulary. Once again, it's like speaking. Mm-hmm. If you have a huge vocabulary, you're going to be able to read and write mm-hmm. in a much more eloquent manner. And having a good grounding in music theory and the technical aspects of organizing the music and learning how the masters have done it mm-hmm. and will give you that much more of a variety, being able to be more diverse in what you offer and more eclectic. And it will allow you to be able to compete on a number of different levels. You know, I can do a soundtrack. Mm-hmm. I can do a gig down on the corner. Mm-hmm. I can go, you know, play with Ray Charles or, mm-hmm. you know, all these things that I've done in my career. And that way I keep working. You know, people have said I'm one of the more working musicians in Seattle or yeah. whatever. And for me, having that solid background mm-hmm. on both sides of the fence mm-hmm. is really been the key for me. And also having a rigid and, you know, really strong professional business approach mm-hmm. about taking care of business.
My guest again is Michael Powers. You've probably seen him playing somewhere. You've heard name. You maybe even more than one of his CDs. We have an opportunity to talk to him now. So you know what? If you have someone who's interested in the music industry, in the music business, tell them to turn on the radio, call them up, tell them Michael Powers is on the radio. We're talking music. We've got some time to chop it up. The new CD, that's going to be coming out is Michael Powers, 20 songs for 20 years.
Yes.
So is this your 20-year anniversary?
Yes.
Okay.
1988, I released my first CD, which was called First Time Out.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what I was doing. I was just trying to do it on a wing and a prayer. It was a little bit, you know, like the guy who made the Hollywood Shuffle with his credit card.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. You know, I was able to get into deep rotation on like 3 different stations here in town.
Mm-hmm.
I got awards. I got written up. I got a week at Jazz Alley. Everything kind of lined up for me,
mm-hmm.
Being able to do those types of things. And here I am 20 years later, putting out another CD. It's all new material.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just like a compilation or anything. It's new stuff. But I did, on one tune, I went back and I played a tune that was on the first CD with a completely new arrangement, and I got all the guys together that were on that first CD to replay this tune in a new way, you know, from a new perspective. The original tune was called You'll Never Know Me, and the new tune is called Now You Know Me.
Okay. Did you think at that time your career would be here in Seattle? Was that your goal, or were you thinking, you know what, I want to go to New York, I want to go to L.A., you know, everyone says, I want to go to L.A.,
yeah,
you know? and that's where the green grass are. So tell me about that. What, at that point, now, of course, this is hindsight, when you first got started, were you thinking, hey, I want to get signed to a major label?
Of course, yes. Next week I was going to be touring and was going to be hanging and talking to Quincy Jones, and we were going to be doing this and that, and I was going to blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was my daughter was born. She's 25 now, so she was a kid when I put this out. And, you know, it ultimately became more important for me to be around and be part of her life and not always be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sure I did a good job at parenting and bringing her up.
Yeah.
And so I made it a point to stick around. And only after, you know, she went off to college, I started doing more traveling, more touring. You know, I just kind of made myself sort of Northwest. I'd, you know, go to Portland, maybe to Spokane, maybe to Vancouver, and be around this area, you know, so that I could, you know, be within a day of home or actually make it back to my house.
Well, we have to thank your daughter for that.
It's all my daughter's fault.
This was also at a critical time. I'm going to say in hip-hop in particular.
Yes.
There was a kind of a shift in the thought process where artists were looking less at a major label,
yes,
and more at putting the music out themselves,
yes,
and having ownership of their product, and again, more creative license as well,
yes,
to do the things that you want to do. Was that also part of your thought process?
No,
at that time?
I mean, I think it just sort of worked out that way.
Mm-hmm.
I've had my music distributed by a couple different labels.
Mm-hmm.
My first time out, I did it on my own. By then, I had garnered enough buzz and attention that people were interested. My second CD, I ended up putting out with Nasty Mix because I had a connection with Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Mm-hmm.
I had actually played guitar on a bunch of his stuff,
including
the Mac Daddy record with Baby's Got Back and all that. So I did a lot of studio work for people. And as it turned out, you know, that record, I got to be number 20 in the country on airplay everywhere. I mean, I think, you know, David Sanborn was number 21 and Natalie Cole was 22 and I was 20.
Okay.
But the problem was they didn't capitalize on the distribution the right way, right when it was all peaking with the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole experience kind of frustrated me and soured me on it, you know, to where it's like, I don't need the ego stroke of saying, oh, you're top 20. I want to sell all those CDs too,
yeah,
you know, and get it out there. And, so I kind of went more back to thinking I'm going to try and maintain control of this and distribute it myself. And, of course, a little bit later down the line, you started seeing the models of the artists being able to totally control it, like when Prince finally got turned his name to the artist, so to speak, just so that he could keep doing it because they own the name Prince, and started just putting records out directly on the internet, directly to their people, and that was kind of a foreshadowing of more and more of what you're saying, you know, in the hip hop world and in the rock world. Now you have, you know, all these big rock acts doing the same thing, even Pearl Jam from here. I think they sell more records. They record every night, and then they make it available on the internet, like right then. So if somebody went and saw their show, they can go on the website and say, "Wow, I can get a CD of that show I just heard," and they'll burn it and send it out to them right away. They're selling more of those than they are of their other stuff.
The new CD is 20 songs for 20 years. We have an opportunity to sit down with Michael and talk about how you got to this point and also get some information from you, from your perspective, because you were an integral part of a scene at that time that wasn't really a scene. Mm-hmm. We can't say that it wasn't a scene, but at the time, folks weren't quite sure what was going on with this music thing. As you mentioned before, it was kind of hard to get gigs. It was kind of hard to play, but you seemed to find a niche. And part of that niche, from my recollection, was that direct contact with your listener, with your audience. Again, was that out of necessity or was that part of the master plan?
For me, it's just an extension of my personality. That's just how I am. I'm kind of outgoing, and I think people find me approachable. And when I perform, I've always used, you know, jazz sometimes gets kind of a bad rap. You know, there's some people think of jazz and they think it's kind of inward, and, you know, and it can be in a situation where you feel like it's a little bit of an inside joke. You know, if you're not one of the hip people, you know, the beatnik kind of era type jazz folks, maybe even Miles Davis was famous for sometimes turning his back on the audience. And really what he was doing, he was kind of turning to direct the guys, hey, hit this, do this here, like a conductor. But people kind of got this perception like, well, what, you know, what is he doing? But my role model's always been like Louis Armstrong, because his approach was, no, this is not an inside joke. Matter of fact, you're all in it with you, and I'm going to make sure you all get the punchline, and that you're with me, and I'm pulling you in. And so I feel like it's my responsibility as a jazz, somebody loves jazz, loves blues, loves the whole American creative musical output, because it's really our American classical music. This is our invention, you know, for that is an export to the whole world. Not unlike hip hop, and, you know, which obviously has roots in jazz. But it's my responsibility to pull people in, to have them see this thing that I love in a positive light, and really see the beauty of all this whole genre and this approach. And so my favorite thing is when people say to me, you know, I don't like jazz, but I like what you do. Because then it's working. Maybe they had some weird preconception, something turned them off. But I'm definitely playing jazz, so there's no question. But it's the way you present it, you know, and the way you try to get it across. And I think people do react to that.
Yeah. Over the course of this 20 years, Michael, I know you've had a variety of different experiences. I want to kind of narrow you down right now.
Yes.
And say, if you can go back over the 20 years, if there's like maybe one or two moments that you can say, this is the moment where I said, hey, I like doing it. This is what I'm going to do. 20 years from now, I'm going to be releasing the 20-year anniversary CD. Was there ever a critical moment where you thought, maybe I'm going to give it up, I'm going to go forward, I'm going to move, and something happened, and said, no, this is it?
Probably there was a station here in town that did sort of an album project that was a benefit for the Woodland Park Zoo. And they had a first edition of it, and the first edition made pretty much everybody on it a star. You know, it was kind of a thing, and it got a lot of airplay, got a lot of connection. So then there was the word that they were going to do a second edition. So this was for Seattle. This was like being on American Idol or something. If you could get a track in and be on this record, man, you were going to get all kinds of stuff going. So I was lucky enough, before I released my first CD, to go in the studio, record some stuff, submit it to that, and I think I might have been the only instrumentalist that made it on. Mostly it was singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. So that's another big breakthrough, is to have your instrumental music presented in the same forum and to stand up with it. Mm-hmm. And I got on the record, and I remember the first time, you know, I'm driving along. Mm-hmm. This is a key moment. I'm driving along, and my tune came on the radio. And I was like, wow, you know, that's it.
That's me.
Yeah, that's me, and... You know, there was this cool tune before it, and there's this cool tune after it, and mine didn't suck next to them. You know, it sounds like it's meant to be there, and it belongs.
Yeah.
You know, that was a key moment for me. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
How would you describe the Seattle music scene? Not one particular genre, but the scene as a whole, from your perspective, to someone who was from another city, maybe the East Coast, and they wanted to have a conversation with you and say, well, tell me about the scene out here.
What's going on with Seattle
musicians? What's going on with Seattle?
I'd say that in general, there's kind of a high literacy rate, you know, as far as technical facility. Mm-hmm. Guys here can play. Why? Because it's rain all the time. They sit around and practice, I think. but in general, the art scene here is very strong. The theater scene is strong. The films, the actual visual art, the dance is strong. You know, there's just a vibrant energy that emanates from here, where a lot of artists are drawn to here. As a matter of fact, on one of those great artists was August Wilson that we had here. And I actually did a tune on my new CD in dedication to him called Two Trains Running, which mm-hmm. was the name of one of his plays. Mm-hmm. So Seattle's always been a place that artists can come and really do well in creating. And somehow it's part of the energy. Somehow it's like I said, it's raining. Let's stay inside and work on our stuff. Mm-hmm. I've become kind of a golf junkie. I love to go golf. You know, I do a lot of celebrity golf tournaments and mm-hmm. things like that. And my whole thing whenever I'm working on a record is, okay, let me get it done while it's raining. I won't want to stay inside and work on this when it's nice enough to go golf. So I hit it just right on time this year.
That's interesting that you mentioned, I guess you would say, some of the attributes of the musician mm-hmm. here. A lot of what we hear is, okay, music's being cut in schools, arts education is being cut back. And then just recently, I guess there's a national jazz competition for high school.
Yes.
And there's 15 finalists, 5, which was unheard of, mm-hmm. from this area, from
right
the
here.
State of Washington.
Yeah.
Garfield, Roosevelt, I know for sure.
Shorewood, I believe.
Yeah. And a couple more from this area.
Mm-hmm.
What do you attribute that to? And again, you have a lot of folks out there who may think that, well, we hear the hip-hop.
Yes.
You know, we know about the alternative scene.
Right.
And we know the history of everybody, the Quincy's, the Ray Charles.
Sure.
And the folks that are Dorothy Dandridge. I mean, you can go on about the folks that have come through here.
Yes.
But yet and still, these young musicians from this area fare extremely well in the national competitions.
Absolutely, yeah. It's because we have wonderful resources, people like Clarence Acox at Garfield, mm-hmm. you know, Scott over at Roosevelt. You know, these people, they're like me in that they said, hey, I'm going to excel at what I'm doing. I'm going to really work hard and do it at whatever the highest level I can do it at, but I'm also going to be here, mm-hmm. and I'm going to make this my home, and I'm going to, you know, actually be here and focus here. Floyd Stanifer was another one of those great mm-hmm. people who, you know, world-class level mm-hmm. of what he could do, decided, hey, you know, I'm going to raise my kids. I like it here. This is a good place, and focused on being here. So the great lifestyle, the comfort of the you know, the natural beauty and all the other attributes everybody's aware of the area, and the ability to be able to create has kept these very vital mentors around. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough when I went to Cornish to have a guy named Gary Peacock mm-hmm. there, who had played with Miles Davis, played, and now he's since left, and he's been out playing with Keith Jarrett and winning Grammys for a while in the Keith Jarrett Trio. Julian Priester is another one of those folks that I was able to tap. But the only reason these people were here is because it was a good creative environment, good place for their family, mm-hmm. you know, to raise. And I think that's the key, is to have this strong role model, strong mentorship for these kids mm-hmm. to come up. I was just speaking with the people. I'm doing one of my release events on June 1st at the Seattle Jazz Vespers at the Seattle First Baptist Church on Capitol Hill, just off of Broadway. And they're going to be giving a scholarship to one of the kids, I think, that was in that national competition, and you know, help them go to college for jazz, and they're gonna have them come sit in and play a tune with me. So that kind of infrastructure, you know, both in the schools and you know, other situations like that where they're trying to support that, I think really helps those things come about that you talked about.
So outside of the schools, in the schools, and then outside of the schools,
yes,
there is a thriving scene here. If you look for it, you can find it.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Street Beat. It's me, your host, Tony B. Our guest is Mr. Michael Powers, Seattle jazz guitar legend. We'll be back to talk more with Mr. Michael Powers.
Street Beat. Street Beat. With Tony B. Cube 93.
Welcome back to Street Beat. It's me, your host, Tony B. This morning, we are listening to the stylings, the sound stylings of Mr. Michael Powers. All the music you hear in the background behind the show is, well, Michael Powers. I want to do something now more on the creative side,
yes,
more into how you create what you do. When you think about writing lyrics, a person expresses a particular emotion. Maybe they put music to it. Maybe someone else writes the music, then they write the lyrics. You do instrumentals.
Yes.
What is the creative process that you use? Is it the same thing? My heart was broken, and and
it
you
can
just
be.
Explore that through the music?
It can be. It can be, you know, whatever kind of an emotional tumult of some kind that you go through. It can be a high or a low, you know, and you express that, certainly. That comes across. For me, with instrumental music, you don't have the words to connect and to really fill out the meaning of it. So it's key for me to have the name of the song really point you in a direction of the meaning and the connection of why the song came about. And then, like in this new CD, I wrote extensive liner notes. There's like 12 pages of liner notes really going on, in this case, because of the anniversary and talking about that span of time and what's happened since then. I talk about a time capsule, like, you know, 1988, the first digital cell phone call was still like 2 years away. So things have changed completely. But as far as the creative process, for me, I like to visualize. I can close my eyes and I can see a scene. Maybe we're at a beach. Maybe it's close to sunset. And, you know, I can hear the seagulls and whatever emotion is attached with that. Maybe it's calming and solemn, or, you know, whatever it is. And I can close my eyes. I can see that scene. I can see it like a movie. And then I write the music as if this is the soundtrack that goes with that movie. You know, that's a way for me to connect with it. And then I try to describe it to people either in the title or in the liner notes to let them know what was I thinking about that. You know, like there's a track that I wrote on the new CD that's called The Fifth Season. And what I mean about that? What's the fifth season? Well, the fifth season is like we've traditionally had four seasons, and now we sort of have this weird, wild card, strange season that pops up. You know, it's like tsunamis and earthquakes, and, you know, it's snowing in April in Seattle and snowing in San Diego, and, you know, floods and Hurricane Katrina and all this weird stuff that should be like a wild anomaly, but it's not anymore. It's kind of like regular, you know. You hear more about these things on a regular basis to where you're almost kind of desensitized to it. I just read that they had a 100-year flood in Ohio, you know, the highest amount of water in the past 100 years. Well, that would be really dramatic and amazing if you didn't realize that last year they had a 50-year flood. So how weird is it? Is it unusual or is it normal? So then for me, that was like, well, how do I express that? You know, my feeling about the environment and, you know, and the inconvenient truth and global warming and all that. So I wrote this tune. It's got like rain sounds going in and out of it. And It's called The Fifth Season. So sometimes it's like trying to express your feeling about something particular that's happened, some kind of a shared event, a world event or something, you know, 9/11 or things like that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a specific emotion, and sometimes it's as simple as, you know, my baby done left me.
One of the things that I think a lot of people love about what you do is you take the guitar and then you play almost every instrument from the guitar.
Yes.
During this change, what was that like for you? Was it a door opening for you? Were there some struggles that you had to deal with in turn? But, well, wait a minute, I'm a guitar player. You know, I don't know how I feel about being able to do the keyboard and the trumpet and the. What was that like for you, or was it just a great opportunity for you to express?
For me, it comes back to the composing end, because I've always written for all these other instruments, even though I'm a guitar player. I would sit at the keyboard and write for the keyboard. I would write for strings. I would write for horns and things like that. And so, what's wonderful about being able to do this stuff? It's like composing for those instruments in real time. And I think of it as guitar. I got to a point where I could kind of do what I wanted with the guitar. You know, not that I was the best guitar player ever or whatever, but I was able to say what I wanted to say, you know, in a pretty concise manner. And I had enough technical facility to do what I wanted to do with it. So I could, you know, I could do it more, better, bigger, stronger, or I could like go in another direction. And so when that stuff became available, I was like the first one knocking on the door saying, get me one. You know, I literally had the first of this. There's this cool thing I use called a VG8. And this was before the synthesizer stuff, but I was able to hook my guitar up and I could play one guitar, but it would sound like 20 different guitars with 20 different amplifiers. And I remember when I went to this, there's a trade show for musicians called the NAMM show every year in California, and I went to the NAMM show, and I was able to see this thing, and I was like, man, I have to have the first one. You know, I'm like an early adopter, you know, if possible, if I can get that stuff. I like technical things. So I think with the technology, I think musicians, it's best to make friends with that stuff. And then use it as a tool. I know that if John Coltrane was around, he'd be using it. You know, I mean, so the purist thing is kind of a weird deal, because everybody we think of as some level of a pure thing, well, they were revolutionary, and they were pushing the envelope compared to the generation before them. You know, and people called them heretics, or, you know, what is this? You're going way off the beaten path. And then later on, they're going, oh, that's classic.
Yeah.
That's great stuff. You know, like, because it's fun to watch. One of my great heroes in that regard is Miles Davis, because he redefined himself. And in doing so, he redefined the music like 10 times. He played with Charlie Parker and those guys and did bebop music. And then he said, okay, that was cool. And when they were doing the bebop, the swing people were going, what are you doing? That's crazy. What is that crazy music? So just as soon as they caught up and said bebop is the greatest thing, he left it alone, started doing cool school music, West Coast music. Puts out Kind of Blue, considered the, you know, desert island disc for everybody. You ask them, if you could only have one CD, people that like jazz, which one would it be that you bring on the desert island? It's Kind of Blue. Has this classic thing. It still sounds very contemporary. So he does that. Then he gets bored with that, and he leaves it alone. Just about when the critics are saying, you know, we didn't understand you, but you're a genius. He's on to this whole other thing. He's into the straight-ahead music he did with Herbie Hancock. And as soon as they got that, he started playing funk.
Yeah.
He created fusion jazz, you know, with the funk thing, with Bitches Brew and all of this kind of stuff. And I don't want to leave people that far away, but I do respect somebody who says, look, if you really liked that thing that I did, hey, here's the CD. I'm an artist. I'm on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. You know, this. I have to keep creating. I have to keep pushing myself and get to the next level and push the envelope. And I think it's important for a creative artist to keep trying to find it. And the technology stuff, getting back to that, that really allows you to open it up. I think like doing guitar is like doing pictures in black and white. Doing it with all its other sounds, it's like color. Mm. Mm. You know?
For you, which album of yours can you go back to and you say, this is the album where I really just wanted to use technology, mm-hmm. you know, and embrace something. Might be a little different for people, might mm-hmm. be, you know, a little difficult for people who are used to Michael Powers.
Right.
You know, which album for you was, you know what, this is where I'm going to say, I want to try some things here that may not be traditional.
Two of them. One is the Live at the Moore Theater. It was a DVD and a CD I did mm-hmm. with my group. Mm-hmm. Big live performance. And I did things like where I played the trumpet on the guitar. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the first time that anybody... I had started doing that at gigs, but that was the first time I recorded it and said, well, that's how I play, man. Here it is. You know, instead of them going, well, where's the trumpet player? Why don't you hire someone? Well, this is what I do. Here it is, you know? And some people would like... And I did an experiment. It was fun. I on the DVD, especially on the tune where it starts with nothing but trumpet, mm-hmm. the last tune blacked out, the lights went down, it was pitch black, and I started playing the trumpet. Mm. And people were like, wow, that's cool, that's a nice trumpet. Then the lights came on, mm-hmm. and it was me. Because, you know, there's a precondition about that stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you doing? Oh, this, you know, is that, you know, fake or whatever? But the thing that makes me feel good is I'll be doing a gig, and one of my trumpet player friends will be in the audience. Mm-hmm. And I'll be thinking, oh, man, he's going to throw something at me when I do this. And, you know, and I'll play and I'll just do what I do. And then afterwards they'll go, you know, I appreciated that you played that like the way a trumpet player would play it. Mm-hmm. Like you really studied it.
Does that require a different feel for you when you go from playing the guitar on the guitar to playing a wind instrument?
Completely different. Yeah. And it makes me play. Because I hear the sound, it makes me automatically think like a trumpet. Mm-hmm. The way they slide, the way that you hold your breath, the way you need to take a breath. Because, mm-hmm. you know, guitar, you can just... You can just keep going. Mm-hmm. But good guitar players actually play like horn players. They go... You know, like that. And it's important to be able to do that and emulate the phrasing and the types of, and it's once again, it's like talking, it's the vocabulary mm-hmm. that is involved. It's important to be able to pick up their things because piano players play little certain things that mm-hmm. make them sound like, you know, a stylist, a certain thing. Mm-hmm. On this record, the latest record, I played the piano. Mm-hmm. I actually played my electric bass. I didn't just play the bass on the guitar, but I just played my bass. Mm-hmm. And I did all the arranging and did all that. I had my drummer do all the drums. Mm-hmm. And then I had a couple key special guests. I had this guy who plays like Miles Davis. He's probably the leading trumpet player in the world that plays like that. His name is Michael Patches Stewart. Mm-hmm. Michael Patches Stewart, when he was a kid, I think he was 16 years old, he played the horn part on Lady Marmalade for LaBelle. Mm-hmm. And since then, he played for 12 years with Al Jarreau. He's done the studio band at American Idol with Ricky there. Mm-hmm. And he is Marcus Miller's trumpet player. Now, Marcus Miller produced all the cool later year Miles stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that band still plays a bunch of those Miles tunes that he wrote and arranged, and he has Patches be Miles. Mm-hmm. So I got as close to Miles as I could get, you know, in this mm-hmm. situation. And then I've got Lee Oscar came in and did harmonica on a track for mm-hmm. me, who everybody knows, Lowrider, mm-hmm. Cisco Kid, mm-hmm. you know, Slipping in the Darkness, the guy who played harmonica in War. And played on all that stuff. He came in and did some stuff for me.
You are listening to The Street Beat. It's me, your host, Tony B. Our guest this morning, while we cool you out on a Sunday morning, is Mr. Michael Powers. We'll be back to cool you out right after this.
KUBE, Seattle, Tacoma. Street Beat. Now back to Street Beat with Tony B.
On Cube 93.
Welcome back to Street Beat. It's me, your host, Tony B. This morning, we are celebrating Memorial Day weekend, well, by cooling you out. Our guest this morning is Michael Powers, legendary jazz guitarist. This is amazing. We've been talking and we're almost out of time, and I still like we have a whole bunch of stuff that we haven't gotten to yet. My guest again is Michael Powers. The latest CD that comes out June 1st.
Yes.
Is 20 songs for 20 years. It's not a collection of other. They're all new material.
All except new material.
Except for one.
That's a redo.
Redo of the from your very first album.
Yes, that was something.
Couple things I want to get to here real quickly, because these are my own personal things.
Yes.
One, at least as far as I'm concerned, one of the great covers, Sarah Smile.
Oh, thanks.
Why did you decide to cover that particular song?
That tune, for me, it just, I connected with it even before I started playing music. I remember hearing it, mm-hmm. you know, just on the radio, mm-hmm. and it kind of spoke to me. It had that tune almost has like a real down-home blues kind of mm-hmm. vibe to it, but in an urban context. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting that I did that particular piece, and I tried to really play it in a way that it would be like the singer would phrase, you know, and really bend the notes and have that feeling in it like the singers would. Mm-hmm. And it's become kind of a classic for me and a kind of a signature piece. Yeah. And I reprised it on my live recording as well.
Let's talk about now the new album.
Yes.
Tell me about it, man. 20 songs for 20 years. What went into making this particular album, CD? What do we call them now? We call them CD. Your work.
I know. I sound kind of old when I say, this is my new record. This is my 78 coming out here.
What went into this? Did you go into it with a particular frame of mind, or were you all over the place? What can people expect when they pick this up and take a listen to
it? The context, the last few CDs I've made have been very thematic. One of the CDs, actually, getting back to your earlier question, that I used a lot of new technology on, mm-hmm. was New Jack Jazz. It was a lot of hip hop beats, mm-hmm. a lot of funk.
I remember
loops, things mm-hmm. like that. You know, really kind of urban mm-hmm. vibe. And like I said, it was a little worried some of the people that liked the other stuff wouldn't like it, but they all said, "Man, this is great. Why mm-hmm. didn't you do one of these a while ago?" Mm-hmm. So you know, it's funny that way. But on this CD, rather than going, that was kind of urban. Then I did a CD called Cinco de Michael, which was all Latin music from all contexts around the world, and it had a very tight theme. Mm-hmm. This one, the theme is to not do a theme.
Okay.
And it's a lot like my first CD, because mm-hmm. I didn't know what was going to work. I just did what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any track record. I wasn't worried about would my audience get it or not. There was no audience. So I just did what I thought, this is good music. Yeah. And this CD is very much that way. It's very diverse. It's very much all over the map. There are some hip-hop moments. Mm-hmm. There are some Latin moments. Mm-hmm. There's some very serene and kind of more inward-looking moments. Mm-hmm. And I felt it was appropriate. You know, you get to the point where you've done, this is my 11th CD, 20 years. Hey, just do one that this is exactly what you feel like doing. Yeah. You're not worried about the market. And I think that when you do it and there's that kind of sincerity, the market comes with you. Hmm. You know, because they can relate to the emotion of it. At least that's the plan.
I know it's June 1st, so we're not there yet, but
yes.
can they get the CD on the website? Is it?
Yeah, right now. They can go to michaelpowersmusic.com.
Not now, right now.
Right now. Right now. Right now. Right
you can
now.
Go to michaelpowersmusic.com and listen, and you can purchase the CD.
Yes, you can
as
start
well.
Taking orders. Mm-hmm. And we're doing that Jazz Vespers on Sunday the 1st. Then we're doing a new venue on East Side, Sentosa. Asian cuisine on the 5th, on the Thursday. The 6th, I'm going to do a solo show at the Fin and Bone. That's all of these are release events because of what I find is certain people come to certain venues, you know, and it's in their neighborhood or it's what they're comfortable with. Fin and Bone used to be McGowan's, the former McGowan's down in Renton. I'm going to do that on the 6th. On the 7th, I'm at a new place on the east side called Jazz at Vertigo. It's Vertigo Lounge over there, doing a show with my band. Then I'm going to be up in Snohomish on the 12th. I'm going to be at Marson's in Everett on the 13th. Liquid Soul Coffee House on the 14th on Saturday. I'm doing a church service, doing my music at the Unity Church on the 15th. The Convention Center on the 19th. The City of Kent Jazz and Arts Night on the 26th. Grazzi's in Bothell on the 27th and 28th with my band, and then the Taste of Tacoma on the 29th. So all of these are release events.
My guest again, Michael Powers. Man, thanks for coming by, man, and doing this advance of the CD release. I feel pretty special right now, Scoop. 20 songs for 20 years. You can go to michaelpowersmusic.com, find out more information. Scoop, let's put some of these dates up on the Street Beat page, too, so folks can go to Street Beat page and see where they can catch Michael for some of these releases. Can we do that?
That's what's
up, TV. All right. Again, man, good seeing you.
Good to see you, man. And I'm just real proud of you and your success and what you do in the community. I appreciate it.
Well,
you know, what you're doing out and being a visible spokesperson, you know, for the community, people of color, all people, you know, about unity and doing things. I've really noticed what you've been doing over the year. I love doing that kind of stuff. I'm always doing community events and doing things in schools, and I've gone and done workshops in all the prisons in the state and things like that. And so I see what you're doing, and I'm proud of you.
Much success to you, man.
Thank you.
Thanks for sticking around. We got to give it to him, Scoop.
Another pillar
in the community. Mr. Michael Powers. Thanks again, man. 20 more years, 11 more albums. We're not going to wait that long to do it again.
Okay.
But 20 more years, 11 more albums. How
All
about
right.
that?
That'll work for me.
We'll make
Thank
that
you.
Work. Thanks for coming by.
All right.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Street Beat right here on Cube 93.